Hello and welcome back to Talking Talmud. I'm one of your hosts, Jordana Osband, here with my friend Chavruta and Gordon. Our daf today, Masechta Bava Metzia, daf Mem Dalet, page 44, where we're going to end Perek HaMafkid, very, very famous Perek, classic yeshiva Perek that gets studied in the Beit Midrash. I'm going to close out by reading the last Mishnah on Mem Gimel, and then... And you will start the next. You'll start the next parak, the fourth parak of Bava Metzia. So again, we're going to talk about a pikadon, right? A deposit that left with a shomer that is misappropriated. Hachoshev leaves shloach yad pikadon. So if a shomer intends to misappropriate a deposit, right? Like he declared somehow that's what he was going to do. Beit Shammai, I'm reading Beit Shammai says chayav. From the moment he makes that declaration, he's chayav for anything that happens to that deposit. Beit Hillel, Riman Beit Hillel says, Eino chayav ad shiyishlach bo yado. Right? He is not chayav until he actually does the misappropriation. So Beit Shammai is basically saying the having the intention is what makes you chayav. And Beit Hillel says, no, you actually have to do the action itself. Shenemar, because the Pasuk says, Im lo shalach yado b'melechad reyehu. And here they're quoting a Pasuk from Shmot chapter 22, verse 7, which says, if he did not lay his hand upon, right, meaning that is the description of misappropriating the deposit, the goods of his fellow, right? So in other words, according to how Beit Hillel understands a pasuk, it means he actually has to do the action. Mishnah goes on and says, Kita et hachavit, if a shomer tilted a barrel of wine that was given to him, v'natal him in a revi'it, and a revi'it of wine fell from it, right? And then later, and Vinishpara, and later it broke, right? Like it just broke through some unavoidable accident. Ana Mishalim El Ravid. He only pays for the Ravid of wine. He's not responsible for the rest of the barrel because he didn't actually do a kinyan on the battle, but he is on the barrel, but he is responsible for the Ravid that he misappropriated. Hagbia did not tell him in a review, but if he lifted the barrel up, which remember, lifting the barrel, lifting something up is an act of kinyan, right? It shows that he's taking ownership of the barrel or attempting to. And then he took a review from it, the nishbara, and then the barrel broke, mishalim demay kula. Then he has to pay the entire value. Okay, so that's the last mission of this parak. The Gemara starts off by talking about another machlokas between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel as to whether the intent for misappropriation causes liability right away, even if it didn't take place. And they want to know this debate that they have, right? They want to understand what are the sources for it? Like, where does it actually come from? So they have a back and forth about that. You can read that part. I want to get to the second part, which is about this barrel, right? Where the shomer tilted the barrel of wine and took a revit from it. And so Rabbah comes and qualifies this and says, I'm a Rabbah, lo shanu ela nishbara. This ruling was taught only in a situation where the aval hechmitza, but let's say the wine turned to vinegar, mishalim it's kula, then he actually has to pay for it all. My time, what's the reason? Gira didehu d'anhula, because his arrows caused the wine to sour. In other words, when he removed that revise of wine, like somehow maybe that action actually caused the wine to sour, because then the container of wine, the barrel was no longer fully full. And by having that extra air in there, it actually caused the wine to sour. Then the Gemara says, he via benatel hemenu, right? If the shomer raised it, the barrel, and took like a, did an actual act of kinyan. Shmuel says, Amar Shmuel, lo natal natal mamash. When it says he took, it doesn't mean that he actually took the revias. Ela kevan sheik bia litol. Rather, what the Mishnah says is when he lifted the barrel with an intention to take it, afal pi shelo natal, even if he did not actually take it. In other words, there, he just has to have an intention to take the revias, and he does that by showing a kenyan. Lema kasavar Shmuel. So are we to say that Shmuel holds that shlichud yad eina tzricha chisaron, that misappropriation is not dependent on the actual loss? In other words, just having the intention is enough. The Gemara says, Amri lo. No, we could say that isn't necessarily true with Shmuel in the Mishnah. What's special here? Shani haka, here it's difficult. Nichale tehebe hachavi kula basis la revi, because the shomer wants the entire barrel of wine to be a holder for the revius of wine that he wants to eventually remove. So in other words, he's going to take that revit, but it's like that revit is stored with the rest of the wine, right? Which better preserves the wine because it's in a full container. So this is a very unique situation, right? And therefore, it's no different than a shomer who removed the actual revit. And then the Gemara asks a question by Ravashi. Ravashi asks, Hibia Arnaki. If a shomer lifted a purse, right, that he had been trusted with, Litol Heminudina, in order to take a coin from it, Maku, what is the law according to Shmuel? In other words, he lifted the purse to show an act of Kinyan. He wants to take a coin from it, but he doesn't actually take it yet. So Ravashi says, Chamra Hu Delo Minater Ella Agav Chamra, right? Perhaps it's only with wine, right, which is not secure except when it's with other wine. So therefore, it's an exception. Aval Zuza Minatar, but with a coin, which by itself is secure, right? It doesn't need to be with other coins. And so therefore, you're not responsible for the entire purse if you remove the coin. O Delmar, perhaps we would say Shani Niturta de Arnaki, right? That the case of the purse is different, Minitura de Dinar, than the security of a single coin, right? Since a coin is more secure than when it's in a full purse, maybe the shomer wanted the coin, right, that he was going to take her and misappropriate later to be stored in the purse, right? Because in a way it's kept better. And so therefore you should be responsible for the entire purse. And the Gemara basically says, Teku. And I think it's interesting what the Gemara does here, because essentially what it's trying to say is that Shmuel raises this good question and they're trying to basically figure it out. Can it be applicable to other areas of halacha? And they basically conclude Teku. They're not really sure. And so with that, Hadron Alayach Amavki. And Anne, I will now hand it off to you to start our fourth parak.
Okay. The fourth parak here, and this is a tricky thing. It's called Hazahav, right? Hazahav, the gold. And it is perhaps, for me, an intimidating parak. It is one of the most mind-bending parakim I've found. So with that introduction, let's just note that it's largely about transactions of money and commodities. And that's where, you know, all the things that we're not, right? Like, I'm not an archaeologist and I'm not a doctor. You are, Yordana, but I'm not. And I'm not a lawyer. And I'm also not a financial expert. And the phenomenon of the transfer or transactions of monies and commodities and how one thing is equal to what value of the other is where we're going to get to that mind-bendingness quite shortly in the initial Mishnah. And then the other thing that shows up here a lot is these halachot about exploitation and where that can even be in part of when the mistreatment is verbal, not just physical. So, you know, we're going to address these questions. You know, what is a transaction? When does it take place? How does it take effect? How does ownership transfer, you know, when it goes from one person to another? And, you know, what does it mean then for the new owner to acquire or to assume that ownership? So it gets, you know, tricky and conceptual, I think, which on the one hand is, I think, very exciting, but it can be sometimes a little bit hard, as I see, to wrap my mind around it. I don't think I'm unique in this. I think it's considered to be one of the more challenging chapters of the Bavas, of Nezikin, and of the Gemara as a whole. Okay, now. We, you know, some of the themes here will come back to, or they'll come out as we discuss them. The Mishnah itself is long. I want to get into it, and I want to try not to get too bogged down into the tricky parts of it. Hazahav kone et hakesef, v'hakesef eino kone et hazahav. Right, the gold buys the silver, and the silver does not buy the gold. Now, there's a lot more Mishnah than this, but this by itself is already a statement of what? Huh? What's going on here? Right? The idea that when you have two different items that what and you're trading them fundamentally, but it's not a trade in the way that we think of, you know, here you give this and I'll give that and we'll call it an even trade. Halachically, there's a concept that one of these items or objects of value, or in this case, metals of value or coins is going to be the acting agent, let's say, that takes possession of the other one and not the reverse, right? So what that means then is, you know, the phenomenon of gold being, the presumption is that gold is worth more. There could be an era when gold is not worth more, but that's the basis here that we're talking about. And the other thing that we need to remember is, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, that when you do a kinyan, when you do a formal act of acquisition, that is what affects the transaction of ownership, right? If you're, I don't know, buying a book in a bookstore, the handing money over gives you the right to take possession of it, but you don't take possession of it until you actually lift up that book, you know, however many tfachim or whatever off the counter, let's say. So what we have here then is the buyer is going to give the money, right? The money to the person from whom he's buying. And the question then is, you've got the one party is taking possession of the gold coins and the other party is acquiring the silver coins. And then what happens is then the next part, you know, if you did the reverse, right? The party that takes possession of the silver coins is not enough for the other party to acquire the gold coins. Let's try to make sense of this again. So if it's not gold and silver, but let's say it's, you know, silver and a book, right? Then I think we can understand that one is the transfer of money and one is then the item that you're buying. In this case, the gold coins are the equivalent, if I understand this correctly, I hope I do, then the gold coins are fundamentally the book, so to speak, right? And Hazahav kone at a kesef, meaning the one person takes possession of the gold coins and therefore the other party acquires the silver coins. Like, because the first party has taken possession of gold, therefore the other person gets the equivalent of, you know, the value is the same, but in the silver coins. I don't think that I've explained that as clearly as it needs to be. And I'm not sure that there is, I'm sure somebody out there can do this in a very fine way with great financial savvy. But the tricky part here is because we're talking about two different kinds of currency. Maybe that's the best way to think about it. We can think about it in terms of, you know, dollars and shekel or pounds or euro, whatever. When you're exchanging monies, then one of them is buying the other. And it's not an equal transfer in halachic terms. So that one of the coin systems, one of the money systems won't bring about the transaction. Only the other system will do so. So here, the gold will do so and the silver will not do so. Carrying on in the Mishnah, so we have a comparable statement in this case. The copper coins will, one takes possession of the copper coins, and then the other party gets the silver, and the reverse does not take place. Ma'ot hara'ot konot et hayafot. If you have bad coins, what does that mean? Bad coins, flawed coins. There's some damage or whatever in the coins that they're not. They're not minted, I think, the way they're supposed to be, right? And what that means is, you know, do they function as money or not? They're considered flawed. I don't know. I don't know. We'll come to discuss later what the different ways that they could be flawed, what that means. They will be what takes possession of the good coins and not the reverse. Asimon kone et hamatbea. If you have an unminted coin and a minted coin, an unminted coin, and the term here is asimon, those of you who are old enough to remember the phone machines in Israel back in the day, and asimon meant a token. And you can also have an asimon for a laundry machine, for example. Instead of actual money, it's a token. So that token is not, it's like a, it's not in the halakhic terminology of the Gemara, it's the coin before it's been stamped to be the coin of the, with the pictures and the heads and tails and values and so on the coin. So the blank coin, so to speak, will acquire the matbea. The matbea is the minted coin. V'matbea eina kone et ha'asimon. The reverse is not true. Metaltlin konin et ha'matbea. If you're giving movable property, you know, in exchange for actual coins. So the movable property is the thing that you acquire the movable property and therefore, you know, the other party gets the coins. Matbea eino kone et ha'metaltlin. But just the exchange of the coins will not get you the rights to the metaltlin, the movable property. Zeh haklal, and I bet you've all been waiting for this. Kol amitaltlim konin zeh et zeh. Once you're talking about movable property, every kind of movable property can acquire every other kind of movable property. That's what I would say is an equal trade for my vocabulary of this or my understanding. Ketzad, how does that work? Mashachimenu peirot v'lo natan lo ma'ot, eno yachol lachzor bo, natan lo ma'ot v'lo mashachimenu peirot yachol lachzor bo. What's the practical implication here? What's going on? How does it work? If a buyer, you know, gets the produce from the seller, produce as an example, but it says peirot, right? And he takes them. He picks them up. He drags them on the floor. He does some kind of formal act of acquisition, and he didn't yet give the coins. He didn't yet pay for it. He still cannot get out of the transaction. He owes that money and he has to pay it because he's already done his formal act of acquisition of the peirot. Natan lo ma'ot, if he gave over the coins, but he didn't yet take the peirot, the item that he's formally buying, right? Yachol lachzor bo, he can say to the shopkeeper, no, give me back my money. I don't actually want this anymore, which is, I think, counterintuitive to the way we think of purchasing now, where I think we would think handing over the money is what brings about the purchase, but not in a halachic sense. Okay, the Mishnah continues. Aval amru, this last case, the sages said, Misha para mianche dor hamabul midor aflaga, hu atid li para mimisha eno omed bidibu ro. It's such a powerful statement. He who, meaning a person who exacted a payment from the people of the generation of the flood and from the generation of Haflaga, the Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babel, right? The generation of the dispersion, he will in the future come to exact payment from whoever, from a person who does not stand in his word, who does not keep his word. The point being that there are generations and we're not getting punished by an earthly court, but they'll get divine punishment. So this is like a strong statement saying that, yeah, there are times when the human court can't do anything about somebody who reneged on a transaction, for example. You know, if you've done your acquisition and you haven't paid for it and you leave and nobody can find you, whatever, like you've still done the wrong thing. And eventually the claim is here in the Mishnah that the, you know, Bidei Shemayim, the hands of heaven, is going to come after you, so to speak. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Kol Shekesef Yado, Yado El HaElyona. And here's this pithy statement, which is kind of like observational and yet, you know, quite true. The one who has money in his possession, his hand is on the upper, right? He's got the upper hand. I think that's the better, you know, idiom in English, right? He's got the advantage. And what that means is it might well be that the money itself, the transfer of money, isn't what brings about the transaction. But that means that the person who has the money is still has the upper hand. Because even if he can't renege on it, right, even if he can't go back, let me say it the other way around, right? If the purchaser has paid for the item but didn't yet take the item, the seller can go back on the sale and give, here, you didn't take it yet, I'm giving you back your money, forget about this. And so that's what it means, that the person who has the coins, who has the actual money, is the one who is in control over whether this transaction can be reversed, even though the money itself isn't what makes the transaction happen, or because the money itself is not what makes the transaction happen.
Well, isn't it sort of saying in a way, I forget what the phrase is, but like, you know, whoever has possession is, it's kind of like it's everything.
Look, the beginning of the Mishnah says that there are some currencies where you're doing the purchasing with some of the currencies and the other currencies don't work to make it, to bring it about. Right. So then the question of me, whoever has the coins in his hand is has the upper hand. That only works if what you're talking about is physical objects versus coins. But if you're talking about an exchange of currency, it becomes a little trickier to say it's everything because.
Right. Well, oh, this is what I was thinking of, is possession is 9/10 of the law. That's the expression I was thinking of.
Yes, I think that's, if we modify that slightly, I do think that's exactly what Reb Shimon is saying here. Like he's saying, you've got the upper hand. You get to control this transaction.
Exactly. That's the idea, right? That if you have the money, you get, there's a certain amount of control you have by you having the money.
But the funny thing is that you aren't, the transaction doesn't happen by virtue of the transfer of funds, which I find to be, it's like flabbergasting to think about, right? The idea that you've paid your money, but you haven't yet taken possession of the thing that you just gave your money for.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I think that's what's puzzling here.
So that's why I call it mind bending. But A, if you're a financial expert, you'll probably find this very, hopefully interesting, but also straightforward. And for those of you who join me in not finding it quite straightforward in the abstractness of the what kind of currency buys the other kind of currency, I still think it's fascinating and you know, really good, intensive mission that leads, obviously, we're going to lead to the Gemara, just not today.
That's our DAP discussion for the day. Rank us, review us on all major podcasts. Thank you to Rabbi Michelle Farber for hosting us on the Hadron website. Let us know what you thought about this DAP on our Talking Talmud Facebook page. And until tomorrow, go and learn.